Welcome to the Commercial Real Estate Investing from A to Z podcast, named one of the best commercial real estate podcasts by Business Insider. I'm your host, Steph Boldrini. We review all aspects of commercial real estate investing and bring the top people in the industry to share their best tips and lessons learned. And in today's episode, we are continuing learning about the richest real estate investor in the globe and how he got there. Here we go. So we ended part one in the early 70s. And by that time, the cities and the county were drawing increasingly costly extractions from the developer. These extractions included roads, flood control channels, parks, and schools. And all of these things were previously provided by the cities and the county. Unfortunately, the trend has only continued to worsen because now the cities will barely respond to us, especially in California. We really need to go through a lot of hoops to get them to work with us as developers. And I just don't understand that because we are trying to make the area prettier, more beautiful, bring something better for the community. So that's interesting how it started. Moving on to 1976, Watson was still president, and the part that I highlighted was that he always claimed that his planning and development was designed to provide a physical environment in which the people would add their own sociological values, which I thought it was very interesting and very thoughtful. Now, moving on to excerpts from the book. The James Irvine Foundation was becoming serious about selling the Irvine Company to comply with the Tax Reform Act. Now, pause here. I didn't understand exactly what the government was trying to do that it made them want to sell. Obviously trying to get more money from people, and so they had to sell. Moving back to the book, the company's revenues and net income presented picture-perfect graphs, with both moving steadily upward during the preceding 7 years. Revenues had nearly doubled in the past 3 years, reaching $104 million. Net income was $11.4 million. So I want all of you to note here that their expenses were about 90%, which is pretty high from my personal experience. However, this company uses the best of the best. So I would imagine that that is one of the reasons why 90% of their income were going to expenses. The concept of taking the company public was dismissed by the board for two reasons. The stock market was not doing especially well, and there was evidence that a real estate company should not go public because Wall Street valued quarterly results rather than long-range objectives. Some people suspected that there was a third reason. With her ownership of 22% of the company's stock, Joan Irvine Smith, obviously part of the Irvine family, would finally control the company, and the foundation trustees, who had long battled the heiress, would not give in to her winning. Instead, the foundation exposed the company to a number of major corporations which might want to diversify into real estate. The only corporation that showed interest was Mobil, which had a real estate development arm. The firm expressed interest in the Irvine Company not only for its land and property portfolio, but also for its planning and development talent, which could be used in off-ranch projects. So this concept excited the president, Watson, and his staff, who had long considered exporting their planning and development strengths to other parts of the nation. So during the periods of negotiations, Irvine Company Director of Public Relations, conducted a national news media campaign to emphasize the strengths of company executives to prospective buyers. So this resulted in amazing articles in Fortune, Time, Newsweek, Business Week, Wall Street Journal, and the New York Times. And all of a sudden, they were in the public eye nationally. So in autumn of 1974, Mobil Oil offered the foundation $200 million in cash, and the foundation accepted the offer. However, this infuriated Joan Irvine Smith, who insisted the company was worth more than $200 million, so she filed suit to block the sale and was successful in interesting the state of California's Attorney General's office. They were the guardian of charitable contributions from foundations to enter the suit. So although her stockholder suit was not considered valid by the court, the Attorney General's suit was accepted. And so in March of 1975, the court blocked the sale to Mobil. So after this, the suit was filed, someone by the name of Cadillac Fairview, a major Canadian real estate developer, read about the sale and received permission to study the company. And in October of 1976, so that's 2 years later from the offer of Mobil. So 2 years later, they entered a bid of $265 million. That immediately drew Joan Irvine Smith's support and Irvine Company management coming into contact with the Canadian firm while exposing the company's plans, and books had positive feelings about the firm. So here we have Mobil and Cadillac Fairview bidding against each other, and an Irvine family member named Keith Gade, an avid horseman, attended a horse show to benefit the City of Hope in Los Angeles. He said hello to an acquaintance, Colonel Bloomberg, who asked conversationally whether the Irvine Ranch had yet been sold. So he answered that it had not, and Bloomberg set off a series of events which brought in a third bidding entity. So here's where things get fascinating, in my opinion. So these are the decisions that change your life. So he called New York friend Herbert Allen, a Wall Street investor, and told him about the Irvine Company and its holdings. Allen contacted a friend of his in Detroit, A. Albert Taubman, who was a large regional shopping center developer and understood real estate. He was interested, and in turn, he interested two Detroit business friends, Max Fisher of United Brands and Henry Ford II. In the meantime, Herb Allen, the New York guy, had interested Milton Petri of New Jersey Petri Stores, and he felt that there was a need for agricultural expertise, and so they involved Howard Mangelas of Agri Giant Sun West. So in November of 1976, so that's 1 month after the latest bid, the second company that entered the bid, this group entered into the bidding war. So now they bid at $285 million. So at that point, this group of people needed additional funding, and Allen contacted another Wall Street colleague. This person worked at Eastman Dillon's real estate investment arm, but the contact was quote-unquote providential, in that this New York person had already been contacted by a Los Angeles home builder, Donald Brand, about financing a leveraged buyout of the Irvine company. And so at that point, in an unnatural but strategic alliance, Brand combined forces with all of these people. And what Brand knew was that they needed to have the heiress, Joan Irvine Smith, on their side. And so the group invited her to become a name part of the consortium, allowing her to continue a part ownership of the Irvine company that she loved, and she accepted that. So this entire group of people made a bid of $302.9 million in March of 77. So that is about 4 months after they themselves had made a $285 million bid. So at this point, a full-scale bidding war was underway, and each day the court permitted the high bidders of the previous day to top the new bidder. And at that point, the second group that came in after Mobil decided that the stakes were too high, and they dropped out. So that left this huge group of people and Mobil. So of course, at that point, people thought that Mobil would win. In May 1977, they bid $336.6 million, and the next day, the huge group of people bid $337.4 million. Note that this was more than a third higher than Mobil's original offer. And the very next day, Mobil announced that he would drop off. Al Taubman, one of the guys from the big group of people that won at that point, he predicted that Mobil would drop out at about 20 times the Irvine company's annual earnings, which were $17 million. That was just $2.5 million over the last offer. So he came in pretty close. The consortium was prepared to go even higher, and the court approved the price and declared Taubman Allen Irvine the winner, and the sale of the Irvine company was completed. And so that marks 112 years after James Irvine acquired the Irvine Ranch, and the company became a Michigan corporation. And so the media had some lovely time saying that the Irvine company was facing a financial challenge. Barron's magazine wrote it was impossible for them to meet that challenge in order for the company to run profitably enough to service the five-year, $100 million loan negotiated by the consortium to purchase the firm. So the way that they structured the acquisition, so Taubman and Brand decided to allow Joan Irvine Smith to become a 11% partner, and they permitted other family members to retain a small percentage. Taubman attracted Fisher, Ford, Allen, Petrie, and Margellis for his part of the deal. And Brand himself, he covered his entire 34% of the agreement with his own money. So good for you, Brand. Apparently, it's good to be a developer. A last thing that I want to remark on this acquisition is that key to the financing of this acquisition was this $100 million loan that was assembled by a group of 9 banks. So when you go this big, you're not just dealing with one bank, you're dealing with multiple banks. And as a cherry on top of the ice cream, the timing of the acquisition could not have been better, because the nation was coming out of the 1973 and 74 recession, and the economy was growing very well in 76 and 77. Here is another hiccup they had. Entitlement for the completion of Newport Center in line with original plans had been completely lost without warning during a single city council meeting one evening with a newly elected, quote-unquote, slow growth city council majority. What they did is they changed Newport Center's remaining commercially designated land to residential. The company at first considered suing the city for downzoning, but they decided that that would be counterproductive in the long run, and instead they decided to wait out the slow growth city council members' terms of office and try to elect a more responsible city council majority at the next election. Fortunately for them, the slow growth city council members were short-tempered and abusive to citizens, appearing before the body on the matters, and with a subtle campaign quietly backed by the company and strengthened by another not-so-subtle campaign by the coal company, whose coal center Newport project near the airport was adversely affected by the council. Several slow-growth city council members lost their seats at the next election to quote-unquote responsible candidates, and the council majority changed. So that is the end of 1982. In 1983, Brann offered to buy out Tabman and his partners by launching his own leveraged buyout of the Irvine Company through a company that he had quietly formed called the I-Corp. The president at the time and the entire Irvine Company were taken by complete surprise. For the 51% of the company, for which they had contributed less than $100 million 6 years earlier, he offered the quote-unquote Eastern shareholders, because they were from Detroit, $516 million. So they determined that they had made a sizable profit, and uncertain about the future of the company because there was another campaign against the company, that which I will explain later, by citizens, these partners agreed to accept his offer. Orange County newspaper reporters tried to uncover why these astute businessmen would sell a company which appeared to have an unlimited financial future, but Taubman would only comment, "My father always told me that you take some and you leave some." And to his hometown, Detroit Free Press, he boasted, "This was a better deal than the Louisiana purchase." But Joanne Irvine Smith objected to the buyout price as being too low and objected to Brann's settling the company with a $560 million debt. The $560 million buyout plus interest due to five banks making the loan. This is for the $560 million buyout plus the interest due to five banks making the loan. This valued the company at just over $1 billion and her 11% shares at about $100 million. She filed suit. So with the buyout also came $560 million of debt. Brann worked with First Boston Company on financing the buyout, and he worked closely with accountants Kenneth Leventhal and Company on how to make the payments. By the way, I'm reading these because they were the top firms in the country at that time. So that you know who to use when you are purchasing a huge share of a real estate company. So the lawsuit lasted quite a few years in the 80s, and after endless months of discovery and depositions, the trial, which was in Michigan, where the company was incorporated, resulted in the judge awarding her $256 million, including accumulated interest. And that is how you get to purchase the entire company. First, he found partners, because he couldn't purchase 100% of the company on his own at that time, he also made sure that in that purchase, he brought in a family member because the other competitors did not bring her in to their offer. And so he kept a family member there as part of ownership. And then just 6 years later, he buys everybody out with another loan. I think this is really fascinating. We still have a little bit of history to go. So there will be a part three. In part three, I will cover a few more problems that they had to go through, as well as my closing remarks on what I have understood this person to be. What are some of the things that you need to do when you get to that level? Who you should be working with? What are some strategies to get things done? I hope you guys enjoyed this episode and learned something from it. And if you did, make sure to leave us a review on the podcast app. This does help us keep being on top as a great podcast to learn from. And I will see you next time.